Why don't we go ahead and get started? Representative Murphy, we're waiting for one member. We don't quite have a quorum yet, members, so waiting for the last member to come, but we're going to go ahead and get started. Representative Murphy, you have House File 2124.
Okay. I do. Madam Chair and members, it's really good to be back before your committee.
Yes, we've missed you.
Thank you. It's nice to be missed. So I'm glad to be back to talk with you today about House File 2124, which has its intention to keep high-qualified teachers in child care centers. And the bill does that by changing the notification statute about who and when a child care center has to notify parents about a teacher who has been granted a set-aside in connection with a maltreatment determination, and it provides an exception in the event of an event that was an accident. I want to thank Ms. Teller and DHS and others. There have been a lot of advocates that have worked on this, and this is, I think, always a difficult area of policy. I think if we're able to move this forward, it'll keep qualified teachers in child care centers, which I think is very important. And I think it will also protect the safety of the children in the care of those child care providers. And I'd like to turn to the witnesses because they have a lot of upfront expertise on this, and they'll be able to tell a better story. And then we can move the bill. Okay.
Well, I think we now have our quorum, so I'd like to call the meeting to order, and then I'd like to move House File 2124 be recommended. Do you have an amendment?
Madam Chair and members, we do. We have the A1 amendment, which if you could move that to get the bill in the order that I'd like it, that would be great.
Why don't we do that? Would you like to explain it briefly?
The amendment has to do with when a memorandum would be posted. So after an event that we believe is an accident, there would be a notification posted in the child care center during the course of the appeal. And once there was a determination made and the determination was made that there was an accident and not maltreatment, then the notice could be removed.
I will move your amendment, Representative Murphy. Move House the amendment A1 to House File Number 2124. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The amendment is adopted. And we also move your bill, Representative Murphy. I will move House File 2124 be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. So with that, we want to welcome you to committee, and if you'd like to proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is Shisa Keller. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Government Relations for New Horizon Academy. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Child Care Association, a group of almost 300 child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. The change in statute is aimed at keeping high-qualified teachers in our centers. The foundation of any quality early childhood experience is the stable, nurturing relationship between a teacher and the child. The current statute results in situations where these teachers are unable to continue working with children. Currently, an incident that most families would define as an accident results in a maltreatment finding by the Department of Human Services, and teachers are disqualified from working with children for 7 years. These findings are a result of a very strict set of rules and statute used by the department aimed at ultimately keeping children safe. A teacher that has been disqualified can appeal the maltreatment and disqualification determination, and the department has the option to grant a set-aside to the disqualification determination. This set-aside states that the teacher will still have a maltreatment determination, but the department recognizes that this individual causes no threat of harm and therefore can continue working with children. The issue is that licensed child care programs, we're currently required to notify all existing families as well as all prospective families that the teacher has a maltreatment determination with a set-aside. As a business, this is not a viable option. Most licensed child care centers have policies where a teacher who's been granted a set-aside are not eligible for employment. The new language changes the notification aspect of the set-aside. This change states that at the time of the set-aside notification, the child care center will notify the families of the children the employee has contact with of the maltreatment and the set-aside determinations, but will not be required to notify future families. This change in statute is aimed at keeping high qualified teachers in the classroom and will still keep safety as a priority. You have in your packets a letter, four letters from families that were affected by such a situation, including Paul Stone. They are examples of how parents recognize that accidents happen, but are equally concerned that their child continues with the relationship with these high-qualified teachers. And now I'd like to turn it over to our other two testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heather Qualley, and I'm a lifelong resident of St. Paul and currently an employee of U.S. Bank, formerly a child care worker with New Horizon for 9 years. I worked with the children for over 20 years and spent over 13,000 hours in my capacity as daycare teacher, Girl Scout leader, youth leader, Sunday school teacher, and parent. This statute has affected me directly due to an accident in my classroom in August of 2007. I was disqualified from being in direct contact with children April 1st, 2008. Because of this statute, I was let go from my teaching position immediately. It took over 6 months for a set-aside to be granted, and in that time I was forced to find other employment outside of the child care teaching arena. It's been over a year, and I'm still waiting for the notification of the fair hearing to appeal the final determination. I'm hoping for this hearing to get a reversal of the final determination so I don't have the label of child maltreater hanging over me for 7 years. The family of the child involved in the accident would have rather I stayed in the classroom. In fact, during the time it took between the original investigation in August of 2007 and the disqualification in April of 2008, the parents of this child nominated me for a Teacher of Distinction Award, citing the way I handled this accident was one of the reasons they found me deserving. I was given the award but did not attend the ceremony on the 17th of April since I'd been removed from the classroom. Please consider the effect of job loss, character defamation, and embarrassment that the current notification procedures have on qualified and caring teachers. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Paul Stone. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm a parent of Ian and Griffin Stone, who both were in Heather's classroom for many, many months and learned a tremendous amount from her. I'm a parent who is also aware that accidents do happen. They happen in my own home with my own kids from time to time, and teachers who are asked to watch multiple children cannot keep track of everything 100% of the time, and when accidents occur, I expect the teachers to handle it the way Heather did, to figure out what they might be able to do differently, centers to do the same thing, what they might be able to do differently, and move on from that. If there's no evidence, and in this case, the parents, everyone involved, knows that this was an accident, and there was no evidence of true neglect, that teachers should have a due process to recognize when accidents occur and not, you know, be removed from the classroom. It creates some pain on the part of the children. There's lack of consistency when teachers turn over like that, and I think the notification process does create some undue burden on the part of centers, and in that, for true accidents, they're having to notify literally anyone that walks in the door of something that could have every bit as easily happened in that parent's home just the other, you know, week or month. So that's in a nutshell my perspective on it. Heather's a wonderful teacher. She did a great job with my kids on the drive into work this morning. I asked them both about what they remembered about her, and my oldest said, I loved Heather a lot, and he really did. My youngest, who isn't as much for words, he doesn't talk a ton, said, I missed her a lot. And this is, you know, after having not been with her for a year now, I didn't prep them or do much of anything, and I wish you were still there.
Thank you. Representative Peterson? Thank you. And I'm not aware of the procedures here, and I'm trying to follow all of the steps that you take and what kind of due process you get and why after this period of time you're still waiting for due process, and so can somebody just walk through the steps slowly and say what happens if there is an accident in a room? Is there an investigation? And is the teacher immediately taken then out of the classroom and an investigation proceeds in a timely manner? And then there's a hearing and the teacher reinstated or dismissed. How does it work in the early childhood area? I know how it works in K-12, but not in this area.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, I'll answer it, and then I'll look to Mr. Kerber if he wants to add anything. Currently, if there was an incident, so say a child is hurt, we're required by the Department of Human Services to notify them that they sought medical attention.
Okay.
It goes into the maltreatment investigation if there is a treatment beyond just an evaluation. So in the case of Heather's situation, a child actually had her finger, as Heather was coming out of the classroom, the child actually put their fingers in the door. There was a door, a finger guard, but it still gave, and the door did close on the child's fingers. And so the child had a fracture in their fingers, and so they had to have buddy tape. So that was the treatment. They had to tape the two fingers together. So because they got medical treatment, it went into a maltreatment investigation. As Heather said, that incident happened in August. August of 2007. Maltreatment came out in September of 2007. And then the maltreatment determination was actually received at the end of March 2008. At that time is when we have to remove her out of the classroom, and she has the ability to request an appeal for a set-aside, and the department is supposed to respond within 45 days as to whether they'll grant that set-aside. So from a center perspective, when an incident happens, we're going to look at the actual incident as far as whether we need to remove them out of the classroom immediately. If it's truly a neglect situation, or they didn't follow policy, or you know they left the child unobserved, we're probably going to terminate that employee immediately. In this district, we probably have already taken action before maltreatment's even come out and investigated the situation. But in this situation, we didn't feel, you know, Heather did everything she was supposed to have done. We didn't feel that she didn't follow any policy. The parents were fine with the situation, and so we didn't take any further action. And so we waited to see what the maltreatment determination was. But once she has that maltreatment determination, then she's not supposed to be with the children. Unless during the appeal process now, she can ask for set-aside, but once she has that set-aside, as centers, we're required to tell all these distinct families, as well as all prospective families, for 2 years that we have a teacher in our center that has a maltreatment determination with a set-aside. Most families coming in that have no relationship with these teachers are only going to hear that they have a maltreatment determination and aren't going to care about anything else. So what we would like to do is to change that notification part so that it's a one-time notification. We tell the families that would be affected by that situation at that time and then be done with it. So the teacher would still have a maltreatment determination on the record, but we wouldn't have to notify the existing families. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it seems like. Really? Okay. I'm sure there are reasons for the rules. It seems a little, many steps and a long time between each of those steps for the teacher. And I'm a little concerned, but this doesn't deal with that piece of it, does it? It deals more with the notification to parents as I'm reading it.
Correct. Representative Greiling and then Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I once slammed my nephew's fingers in the car door, and I did that myself. It was not it was an accident, but I suppose they would have cut my head off with these sort of rules for that. It sounds much more intentional than what Ms. Quayle did. I'm just wondering, did you say that there was a determination, or you're just waiting for a determination? I don't see how it could be a determination if a child's fingers got accidentally shut in a door, that the determination is that there was maltreatment. Did that happen, or are you just waiting for a determination?
Who would like to answer that? Ms. Qualley?
Madam Chair and members, I appealed the original finding that I was given in April 1st, and I had 30 days to do so. I filed the appeal for both a set-aside and a reversal of the final determination. It's a two-step process, which the set-aside says, I made a mistake and there was an accident and it was my fault, but I'm not a danger to children and I can keep teaching. But it comes with the 7-year blanket of a label. Then there's a reversal of the final determination, which is basically you weren't found guilty of anything wrong. So I had 30 days to appeal for both of those. I did that. It's supposed to take 45 days to get the DHS response. I didn't get it until October of 2008. So it took almost 6 months for that. And then I got the set aside at that point. By then, I had already found another job. So I could have gone back to New Horizon and worked there with this label and with the notification of everyone that came through the door. I didn't feel comfortable doing that. And then now, with the second part, after I got the determination, I got the set aside, I then was able to appeal that within 30 days and request a fair hearing on the final determination. And I still have not had a response to that. And that was processed in November of 2008. So I'm still waiting to get the fair hearing. So it's taken a while.
Well, this just seems like not very good common sense, but I don't know if Representative Murphy, I'm glad Representative Murphy brought forward this bill. I'm wondering if it even does enough with this kind of situation. My mother's in the nursing home, and the couple last month, they gave her the wrong medication, somebody else's medication. She almost died and went to the ambulance to the hospital, and she survived, and being the person that she is, she would refuse to sue, as my daughter and some others thought that she should. So they just apologized, and she said, that's all right. But we didn't have to notify everybody else that comes through the door, and they practically killed her. And so now with children, though, we seem to have this overkill situation. And I just wonder, I know we want to protect children, and we certainly do. I have a granddaughter, too, but I hope we could have a little more sense in the world.
Ms. Doeful, do you have a comment before we go to Representative Hamlin?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Valerie Doeful, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, which are licensed child care centers such as New Horizons and KinderCare. And I would like to clarify with the members, Representative Freiling, you bring up some very good points, and these are issues that the centers we work with have grapple with. And we've had a lot of conversations with the licensing division and with Gary Kerber, and we really appreciate their efforts to help us come to this language. Certainly it's something I hope that we can continue to look into, but this language has been carefully crafted and worked out with folks over in the Senate and with and Jerry Kerber can comment on licensing's position. I don't want to speak for them. But I hope it's something we can look into the future. I hope for today this is something that can move forward as is.
Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple things. Bear with me on a few of the questions. I'm a little naive, and I'm just trying to gather more information. A lot of times the legislation that's passed has good intentions and unintended consequences, and I just want to thank the testifiers for sharing your story. I know it's not always easy. So a couple questions. The original language that we're looking at changing, when and why was it first put in place?
I think I'm going to ask the department.
Yes,
or
Madam Chair.
Mr. Kerber, we'd like you to come down and answer Representative Hamilton's question, please. And welcome to the committee, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services. And we license child care centers, and we conduct background studies, and we can also complete maltreatment investigations in these facilities. And I believe, Representative Hamilton, your question was, when did this notification requirement get put into the law? And that occurred in 2005 legislative session.
And Madam Chair, the other part of that is why? What was the need, or what was the thought process for the need for this legislation?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, this was an initiative not by the administration. It was not from the licensing division or the Department of Human Services, or and it wasn't part of. There was that same year there was a major effort by the governor's office to make some changes to the to the Backrow City Law that we've heard about many times. This was an initiative that followed, as I recall it, a Minneapolis newspaper article about child care that kind of highlighted that the Department of Human Services was setting aside disqualifications of people with various criminal histories, and that we were doing it in a way that it was not known to the parents who were receiving services from those child care providers, and no different than any other type of license program. But that was the concern raised in the newspaper article. And so in response to that, there were a number of proposals that were initiated, and this is the one that passed that just required child care providers to provide a written notice to the current parents and prospective parents that the Department of Human Services had made a decision that somebody does not pose a risk of harm. And the idea was that at the time that, you know, parents ought to know that and perhaps make their own decision about that. There was also the posting requirement was part of that initiative too, that child care providers were then required to post in a prominent location correction orders or negative action letters that we had issued. And if an action that we took at a child care center was affiliated or had affiliated with it a maltreatment investigation finding, then in those cases, only that investigation summary had to be posted with it.
Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, how do we differentiate, or does this, in your personal and professional opinion, will this differentiate between what was originally the motivator for this language and the testimony that we just heard today? I guess what I'm saying is there is a difference between individuals that are causing harm to children and working there and hiring them, et cetera, compared to the testimony we heard today, where to me it seems logical to be able to address one without punishing the other. And I'm just wondering, does this language do that in your personal and professional opinion?
Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, the way the background study, what we have kind of in play here are licensing standards and background study standards and maltreatment standards. And so there's sort of like three sets of decisions that kind of come together in this situation. And maltreatment investigations are done according to the state's Maltreatment of Minors Act. It's the same statute that's used by counties to do child protection. And there are some very specific definitions in that law that we need to, when we get a report from somebody that something happened, we need to investigate that thoroughly according to the guidelines in that law and make a determination as to whether or not that incident occurred, and if it occurred, does it meet technically the definitions in that statute? And if it does, then we must call it maltreatment. Then what we take that finding, and then that becomes part of, that folds over into the background study law. Because the background study law says not only are sex offenders and murderers and people commit assault, not only are they disqualified for much longer periods of time, but for 7 years, people who commit certain types of child maltreatment are disqualified as well. And it has to be either serious or recurring maltreatment, and those definitions are clearly in statute. And so what's coming together here are kind of those two laws and then the licensing rules that this stuff gets posted and distributed to people. And so the laws sort of, in a way, treat the people with the most serious criminal records similarly to those with less serious criminal records or incidents of maltreatment. The safety valve for the individuals involved and for the facilities involved is that there is a sorting process, and I have to apologize for how slowly that has proceeded here, and that's the result of a number of factors. But there is a process in place to appeal all of those decisions, but the safety valve is that the Commissioner of Human Services has the opportunity and the responsibility to take a look at individuals like those you've heard from and decide whether or not, you know, does this person pose a risk of harm. Certainly we see in many cases where wonderful caregivers do something on a day that has an impact, has an effect on kids, and has an impact on their career. But that's sort of, the system allows for us to say, you know, that person doesn't pose a risk of harm, and let them work. So then when you lay the other consequences on here about that notification has to go out, oftentimes there's not ample opportunity to explain probably to the prospective parents that this was an incident where, you know, the child's finger got caught in the door, and it isn't an incident where somebody had, you know, had robbed the bank or had, you know, had some kind of sex crime or something like that. I mean, there's a whole range here of types of things in play.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
We have to determine, we have to be able to define and outline the differences. If this is perceived at all, or if this is lessening the restrictions on the sex offender, someone who robs a bank, in order to protect the testifier, there's absolutely no way I'm going to support it. Absolutely no way. However, I am extremely concerned and extremely frustrated that the individual that testified here today would even be considered in the same group as the previously mentioned. That's a disservice to that individual as well. It's truly not fair. And so I guess I'm looking to the department on how we can do that to differentiate the two and give some latitude, if you will, because if the changes that we're trying to make here in this bill, if that reduces the restrictions any way, shape, or form on the sex offenders, someone who robs a bank or whatever, there's no way I'm going to vote for it. There's no way I'm going to support it. So could you please speak to that as well?
And Mr. Servers, we have a response to this as well, but we aren't changing any part of the process that deals with making a determination about maltreatment or a set-aside. None of that is being changed. The only thing that we're asking to change is the notification after a set-aside has been granted. So all of what Mr. Servers is describing in terms of the body of law that's been established about the tools that they use, the instruments they use to protect the safety of the kids, is intact. We are just asking that the notification process of that be changed. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Mr. Kerber?
If that answers questions.
Representative Hamilton, we have three other people on the list, so we might get through some of this also with the other questions.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to know, Madam Chair, thank you, just want to know if there's a way that we can determine, you know, the severe individuals and versus everyday accidents or whatever.
Ms. Qualley.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just wanted to comment on how, if this wording had been in place, it would have affected my job. With this wording, I would have been able to stay in the classroom while the determination was being made, because my employer didn't think that I was a threat and this was an accident, so I would not have been terminated. At the time then, waiting for the set-aside, there would have been notification, and it would have been like me being on probation again prior to getting my background study cleared. So there would have been, you know, safety measures in place to make sure that I wasn't alone with children and things like that. Once that set-aside was given, all of the families and people involved in the center at that time would be notified that I was granted this set-aside and that this is what happened and this is why. And then from that point on, I would be able to be in that classroom. I would still have this determination, but I would have been able to remain in the classroom. So for me personally, I would have been able to keep my job and stayed with children. So that's big.
Representative Nornes, and then Representative Ward, and then Representative Lane. Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, first of all, my wife's fingers were in the car door one day when I slammed the door, so I'm in worse shape and more trouble than you, Representative Driley. I find it hard to understand, I guess that kind of following Representative Hamilton's line of questioning there, but just to find fingers in the door and treat that as maltreatment, it's hard for me to agree with that, I guess. My question, though, is how, I'm curious to know how many investigations of this type is your office doing in a year? Is this, it could be, is it a big number?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, our office does, in child care centers, we do about 150 a year, 150 maltreatment investigations a year. And we substantiate maltreatment in probably a quarter to a third of those, and in probably a quarter to a third of those, we find an individual, we find the facility responsible. When we do a maltreatment investigation, if there's a determination that something happened that met the definition of maltreatment, the next responsibility we have is to figure out whether an individual was responsible or whether the facility was responsible. And we do that according to criteria that, again, are in the law. In looking at things like, did the individual, first of all, did the facility have adequate policies and procedures in place? Did the facility train the individual they were supposed to? Was there adequate supervision? Were the staff ratios being met at the time? Staff-child ratios, those kinds of things. And if the facility was not really in compliance and doing what they were supposed to do, then we say, well, the facility was responsible for that, not the individual. However, if the facility did everything that they should have done, they had adequate policies and procedures in place, the training was adequate, the supervision was adequate, all the staff ratio requirements were being met, then we would say, okay, an individual chose to not follow one of the facility policies and procedures, or didn't follow the procedures, and then the individual is responsible for the maltreatment. And so that's probably in about two-thirds if we substantiated 50, probably two-thirds of those would be where we blame an individual for the maltreatment.
I'm sure this one thing I'm also curious about, how large is the staff? How many people are doing this work?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, that has varied over time, and that has played a role when we've had stresses on the general fund budget. Currently, completing maltreatment investigations, each maltreatment investigator completes about 50 a year, 50 of these investigations. And right now we complete about a total of about 1,000 a year in all types of settings. And we've got roughly 25 investigators to do that.
And one final, it seems pretty unreasonable that it's taken this long in this particular case, but is the process, does it allow for, say, an investigator to, in a very short time, realize that this is a very minor situation and make a ruling? Or is there a process? My son was in a car accident once, and the lawyer said, well, it just takes this long to go through the process, which is about 18 months. Is this a similar situation where it's just a process that takes a long time, or can you, in a very short time, make a determination and end the whole agony?
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, there's no minimum required of time for us to complete these things, to be sure. And our timelines are getting better. The statute suggests that we complete these investigations within 60 days, and today half of them are completed within 60 days. This, as you heard, I think was a while ago. I think it was 07 is when the incident occurred. And so we're getting better at this and getting faster at it as we're able to keep the resources up to speed. There's an elaborate appeal process, too, that you heard parts of. And so if we substantiate that there was maltreatment, whether it's an individual or by a facility, there are appeal rights. And so they can challenge that maltreatment investigation finding. There's an administrative reconsideration that they get first. And then if it's upheld in the administrative reconsideration stage, then there's a fair hearing right, as you heard about. And that's what the other witness was talking about waiting for at this point. And those get scheduled in a process, and the Attorney General's office represents the department in the hearing, and often the individuals are represented. When we have facilities who are responsible for maltreatment, they're in the same process. Parallel to that is the background study system. But work has been done over the years to consolidate all the appeals into one. And so from the individual's perspective, as you heard, she can appeal everything all at once, and the process is dovetailed, and so the decisions are just made along the course of the way.
One quick one to wrap up here. Does the defendant, maybe that isn't the right word, but are lawyers involved here? Are they required to have, do they have to spend you mentioned the Attorney General's office representing you. Mm-hmm. I assume then that they would need a lawyer to represent them. Is that typical or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, it's certainly not required. What percentage of people have lawyers, I'm not sure, but many do, quite honestly, but certainly not required.
Okay, thank you. We have a couple more on the list. Representative Ward, then Representative Lane. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we start talking about fingers and doors, it really starts scaring me for sure. I didn't know that. Mr. Kerber, protecting children is all of our number one goal. I'm somewhat appalled of what I sense and agree with Representative Hamilton, Representative Peterson, all of us have asked these questions. We have a child care worker that clearly loved children and did her job. And she spent a year out of that mode making an impact on children because of a department situation. Now, I heard you say you had 150 cases per year that you investigate, and you've gotten better. We've gone from years of holding people out of their job to, I think you said, 60 days. That's what I heard. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I hope that I'm not going to belabor the point either because I know I'll run out of time, but I really hope that the process continues to get better because we've got a lot of need for our young children to have people like Miss Qualley, and we need her and others to make an impact on these children. So I hope the department still continues. And I was going to ask that question. Does this language make any difference now? Miss Qualley got there and said, if this language is in, I would be able to have been still in that classroom, so I'm glad to hear that. Let me just ask one quick question, though, Madam Chair, please. Is this, you said 150 cases, is that child care centers? Is this how about private daycare facilities? Does that include that 150? Does that include that as well?
Ms. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, the 150 would be child care centers. I'm not sure what you mean by private. As opposed to centers, as opposed to family child care.
Correct.
There are 1,600 child care centers in the state, and so this would be 150 a year in those 1,600 child care centers. That's not talking about the 12,000 family child care settings. Those, when there's an event in one of those settings, it's investigated by Child Protection, the County Child Protection Agency, under the same law, using the same standards, but just different agencies.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton, to that point,
Madam Chair, just to that point, and I think that's, we're on the same page there, but I think in defense of the department, what I'm trying to ferret out as well is this time process is probably law in which they're following. And so how can we change that to where we protect the individual that was testifying here and treat that one way and have additional scrutiny in sex offenders or whatever on the reason why this law was put in place in 2005? So it may be a catch-22 right now for the department as well.
Representative Lane.
No, I'm thoroughly confused because all I see in here is notification stuff. And it really is notification in a child care center, not even having anything to do with family child care, anything. It's just child care centers and notification information. I don't even see how it would have affected this particular case, because it just says, except is in here, the investigation will be posted. Except here, the investigation will be posted. And the exception is that once there's a set-aside or a variance, you just notify once and you don't have to post it anymore. That seems to me to be the extent of the bill from what I see. I don't see anything here that has anything to do with even helping this teacher get back on the job. I may be wrong on that, but all I see here is when you have to notify, period.
Ms. Cohen.
Madam Chair and Representative Lane, that is what we're, right now, really what our focus is we're trying to take some steps into being able to protect these teachers. And right now, we just want to be able to keep the teachers we have in our program. And in being able to change the law and how we have to notify families of a teacher that has been determined to have disqualified and has a set aside, our biggest issue is that we don't want to have to be forced to tell every family that walks in the door that we have these teachers. And so that's why we're trying to change the notification part of it. We're not trying to change how the department does their their determinations, any of that process. We're just trying to change this part. So from a business standpoint, we're able to keep these teachers in there and not have to have them labeled as maltreatment terminated teachers for 2 years.
Representative Lane, this bill specifically focuses on this on another time, and we could have testimony more on this process.
Right, so I think some of the conversation has been not relevant to this particular bill.
Yes.
And I just say again, the only thing that changes is, maybe for her, is that after there's a set-aside or a variance, I guess she has the set-aside, but she doesn't have the reversal yet, but as there's a set-aside, then, and only then, would you be able to go forth without having to, notify the parents once, and then you're done with that.
To the testimony
has been relevant to this bill, and the reason it is because if I'm a parent and I'm going in there, and if you have a sex offender in there, I want to be notified, and I want you to be forced to notify me. And if it's something minor, then not.
Members, what we're going to try to do is get through this bill and address the items in this bill. And as the chair, I have given probably wider latitude because we do not have bills like this in front of this committee very often. I don't know if we've ever had a bill quite like this. So I've been given some wide latitude. We need to start to cinch it up, though, and get through the bill and take a vote here. Ms. Oakland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remember, I just would like to respond to Representative Hamilton's earlier question, especially in reference to a sex offender. A sex offender would not be given a set-aside and would not be allowed to work in a child care center, nor would a child care center ever employ, knowing that someone has committed and been convicted of a crime against a child, especially a sex offender.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's why I said earlier that nothing in this piece of legislation tugs at all at the policy or regulatory scheme already in place dealing with the protection of kids in child care. All we're trying to do is change the notification after a set-aside has been determined. So it's the body of law here is complex. I've worked with Mr. Kerber in dealing with vulnerable adults, also a really complex body of law. And it may be subject matter for your work in the future in the committee. But I want to be really clear that the scope of this piece of legislation is very narrow, and it is just to be able to allow child care centers to be able to use a different notification process when a set-aside has been determined.
Thank you. Last question, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see so many things, at least, that I do think need to be worked on, including the criteria and timelines and due process. But I guess I think I understand, at least, because I carried a piece of legislation about notification regarding sexual predators a couple years ago. And I concur with Representative Hamilton. I don't want to undo anything, but you've assured me that this does not affect that. And I would say to Mr. Kerber, do you see any problem with this?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, members, I think that the department is neutral on this. The notification requirement, I think, as I mentioned, wasn't initiated by the department, and it wasn't initiated as part of the governor's bill in 2005. And I apologize for using the example of sex offender because in that same legislative session, the discretion for us to grant a set aside to sex offenders and many other people who have committed more serious crimes was removed by the legislature. And so the posting, the notification, it's hard to know. I mean, what is the right amount of information the parents should have? And, as we've talked about here, it's a very complicated issue. And certainly, What we've seen enough of, I think, is we've seen enough to know that a parent being told that there's somebody working here who has a set aside of a disqualification can conjure up ideas and fears that that would need some explanation. Ideally, there would be more education about what is the set aside of a disqualification really means. It means the Department of Human Services took a very, very careful look at this and decided this person doesn't pose a risk of harm to kids. And so, there's a whole world of education that could be provided about these situations that isn't typically. And so as we hear, the individual who has the set aside is very often out of the job.
I'd like to go to Representative Downey, and then I'd like to move to a vote.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. I will make a very just brief statement and say I think we're all struggling, especially those of us who weren't here in 2005 and understood from the testimony that this body of protective process in human services is designed for this broad spectrum of cases, all the way from the most extreme to the ones we've heard here today. Leaves us really, I think, in a hard spot. I'm going to actually, you probably have a perfectly good bill here, but I'm going to have to vote against it today and would maybe just encourage that if you could provide our committee a little bit more of the complete process and where this little tiny notification element exists in that, that would help us. And who knows, assuming you get it to the floor, we'd maybe even be able to vote for it there. But I'm just really struggling not having that big picture that Mr. Kerber explained really concrete in my mind. So, thank you.
Members, want to take the vote. Mr. Kerber, I would like you to have some follow-up with the committee regarding Representative Downey's comments and some more information for the committee about the process.
Yes, ma'am.
I renew my motion that Representative House File 2124 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. So, it's passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing us in the city.
You're welcome. Thank you. Members, Representative Bly is going to come chair. We have one more bill on the committee. And we need to move the minutes. Representative Mariani, would you like to move the minutes? Okay, thank you. Representative Mariani moves approval of the minutes for March 31st. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes for March 31st are approved. Members, this will be our last bill, which will be House File 2028. I just wanted to let you know the process over the next couple days. The bill will come out Monday at noon. Then we will be getting amendments, I think, before the break. Is that right, Representative Downey?
Yeah.
Yeah, before the break, we'll have our amendments.
Yeah.
If we can, okay.
Yeah, a couple of
minutes. If you can get us, that would be helpful. And then the legislative break will start, and then we will come back next Tuesday and hear the amendments and pass the bill out. Now, it's an interesting calendar. It's just the way it calendars out with everything. So with that, Representative Bly, are you ready to chair?
So, Representative Flower, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2028 be recommended to pass and move to the general register.
Okay. And you have an amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. It is the A1.
So I would move the A1 amendment so that we can get the bill in the shape that the author would like. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members of the House, file 2028 was brought to me actually by Senator Torres Ray, who's here. And upon the idea of this is a bill that was passed in New Mexico, and where they did an inventory of all the early childhood services from the Department of Education, the Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services. Now, it's some of you may think, well, do we need a bill just to do that? And it is not as easy as you think to coordinate and find out what all the services are under each of those departments. One of the reasons we need to do this is we're moving towards an Office of Early Childhood, which is Representative Peterson's bill. And if we want to get there, we need to know what services throughout the state are serving young children. When we heard Dr. Bruce Perry come and talk about brain development and focusing on especially small children, that wouldn't it be a great conversation here at the legislature if we could talk about what's the best thing for kids? And as we know, we often do that in this committee, and Representative Grinley does that in her committee, and Representative Mariani does that in his committee, but we rarely take a child across the board and say, where are all the services, and how are we serving those kids? We're hoping eventually with the Office of Early Childhood, which we're moving to put pieces into place, this would line up with that, and we would know exactly which services are where. When Zoe Nikolai was here, she passed out a chart, which I'm trying to, I know I have it here somewhere, which talked about here, where you have the three departments and all the different things from MDE, DHS, and MDH. And I would say the one that's probably the most unfamiliar to us would be those in the Department of Health, things about children with special health needs, follow along program, early hearing and detection, those types of things, so we can know where everything is, where the money is, and where the money should be, hopefully. I have a testifier here today, and I will let them talk more about the bill.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the
yeah. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Eric Haugy. I'm the Government Affairs Specialist with Ready for K. I'd like to first thank Representative Slawick for bringing this bill forward. We do support this bill. As you maybe know, there have been efforts over the years to capture the information that's included in this inventory, but none have been as broad and detailed as this. For example, in the fall of 2005, the Itasca project completed a review of public and private spending in early care and education. Most recently, the Wilder Foundation, in conjunction with the Early Childhood Business Plan, completed an asset review of early care and education in Minnesota. I believe you all received that in your packets last week. While these have certainly been worthwhile and useful, they did not include the breadth of information being requested in this bill, particularly the data around geography and demographics. Additionally, those reports were snapshots in time and not specifically meant to guide legislation and best practices, whereas this legislation specifies that the inventory shall be updated every biennium. Finally, I think amending this bill to charge the Advisory Council on early care and education with this task will mean that this inventory is being done in an intentional manner within a broader context. And as Representative Slavik mentioned, perhaps if the Office of Early Learning moves forward this session, this might be an appropriate task for the office to coordinate as well. I would also like to add that this new task for the council will fit in well with the federally required tasks, which charges the council with conducting a periodic statewide needs assessment concerning the quality and availability of early childhood education and development programs and services for children from birth to school entry, including an assessment of the availability of high-quality pre-K services for low-income children in the state. So this will certainly supplement the work that's being done by the council and is an appropriate place for it to happen. Thanks again for allowing me to testify on this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee might have.
Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Norris.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. 1.14, on that line, it says provide budget allocations toward the outcome areas. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Representative Norris, what we're trying to do is I can show you the New Mexico one, which I have right here, is it talks about it will give an allocation area like families first. And then you have the state, federal, and total, so that you're getting the whole picture of what's happening there. So on 1.14, it would be both the state and the federal, and then the area, obviously, that's budgeted under.
Isn't that the 111? One point that says identify the programs and initiatives funded by the state, federal, and private dollars. And 1.114 is identifying those dollars. Is that what it's supposed to mean?
Yeah. I think that it gets more towards what the outcomes are. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing is we're trying, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton, to move towards priority funding here and zero-based budgeting. I've met, requested from both commissioners that information, and actually got much better information from the Department of Human Services, where we can tell more clearly what the outcomes that they're shooting for, and we hopefully are too, what we're trying to accomplish.
Any other questions? Representative Dowling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this. I'm curious, your amendment changes the responsibility from state agencies to the advisory council. I'm curious what the rationale behind that change was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downing, the council met today, so that was one interesting thing. So we're fresh from that meeting. I think that was actually following the lead of the Senate to move it from the departments into the council. As our testifier, Mr. Hauge, stated, the council is charged with this already to start doing this, but theirs is more, say the wording of exactly, theirs doesn't necessarily do it in this level of detail for the dollar amount. So we feel like it's a good fit. Richard Chase from the Wilder Foundation is working on some of this for the business plan and doing some of it with the advisory council. But this adds not just what the services are out there and what's happening, because it's a much broader picture, but then it ties it back into the dollars. So it seems to make sense that it would give us a good picture, and then it gives the governor's council a good picture at the same time.
Representative Downing.
Does that imply there isn't any cost to the state then?
Mr. Chair, I hear my blackberry going off.
Yeah.
Probably just my kids if you want to pick up. But no, that's okay. You can press the red button and it'll go off.
Okay.
Representative Downing, we had talked about funding. I think the departments, I know MDE is here and I think DHS is here, and I think they testified that there is a neutral cost in the other committees if they want to come down and talk about that. But also, there is some funding. The council does receive funding. I know MDE provides staffing for the council. Can I ask the esteemed senator to approach?
Yes. Would you like to comment, Senator Torres?
Thank you, Representative. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, we went through this, and the questions came up in our body as well, so the same questions. Representative, the reason we did this change is precisely because of the reason that Representative Flowers just addressed. We have a council, and in fact, the council, when I started this whole process, I wasn't fully aware of the mandate of the council. They do receive money to do this, federal money to do it. Not a lot, but they do have funding. And we put here human services, health, human services, and education, but they already represented in the council. And they already received money to do it, so it made a perfect sense that we just asked them to do it. And if we wouldn't have done it this way, without this amendment, we would have had to put a fiscal note to it, because it's a separate mandate to do the same thing for the same agency, so it would have been duplicative work.
Okay. Representative Downey, you have another question?
I should. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. It seems most of the information that we're trying to aggregate here would be pretty readily available, but I'm curious about the 1.17 through 1.19, I guess. How reliable will that information be? It seems like people moving in and out of these child care programs and systems seems to be really fluid. What was the experience in New Mexico, and do we think there'll be a reliability question with those data elements?
I'll make a comment, and then I have to represent the chair of Sunday. I'm not sure with New Mexico. I know that I have another bill that I'm trying to get people interested in. It's about assigning Mars numbers to little kids, so we actually could track them, and if they're in the child welfare system, with all these overlaps and all of these kids, we would know actually where they were and what's happening with them. But believe me, with all the data practice issues around this legislature, that has not been an easy bill to pass. I think In terms of knowing number of children eligible, things like home visiting and some of these programs, we would know. Some are income-based programs, or, you know, we actually at the council today, it was interesting, we got to vote on how people want to proceed in the direction of the state. Do you want to do at-risk kids? Do you want to do first? It came out first to K, actually a low vote. It was first to three, and then it came out with needs that people wanted all the needs represented. Well, there's an enormous amount of needs based on income, special needs, language needs, and all of those types of things that could be represented out there. So will it be exact? I actually mentioned myself that here at the state, we tend to stick with income because we know that one. How many, if a language is not the, English is not the primary language in the home, do we really know? I think that's an excellent point. How are we going to quantify things like that? But I left in the middle of that, so I don't know some of the people that were there, how that came out, but the committee is very interested in trying to find that out. But I think your point's well taken from my viewpoint. I think that's going to be, on some of those need issues, more difficult to find. I don't know if Senator Torres-Ray has a response.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Actually, we do know about every single kid that is eligible for all of these programs, because ultimately they, you know, families have to apply through the counties or through, you know, the different programs. The counties will determine if they are eligible, let's say, you know, Head Start. And then we know who is eligible, we know who receives the program. So we are actually creating an inventory of the programs, and hopefully, you know, obviously those programs will know which children are enrolled in the program, which children. Sometimes the fact that the children is eligible doesn't necessarily mean that it's enrolled, because they don't have enough, some programs don't have enough funding, so we have a lot of, you know, waiting lists for some programs. And that's why we are specifically saying eligible and enrolled, because some children are enrolled, are eligible, but they are not enrolled. And we need to know about both, because ultimately what we want to know is if we're going to ever put the resources in place for young children. And that's the reason for having those two centers that kind of separate, so that we have information about both groups of children.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Downey, you know, the Senate always knows best. Senator Torres-Ray, Senator Torres-Ray has an extensive background in human services, which is showing over my, you know, sort of United Way profit, nonprofit background. So she knows the stuff for him. And that's so.
Representative Mariani, did you have a question? I wasn't sure if you...
I was just commenting on that theoretical statement. However, I do concede that the Senator Torres-Ray has quite extensive professional experience in this area.
Okay. Any further questions? Did you have any other comments you'd like to make, Representative Falk?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your consideration. I think this is a good bill, and I think it will be interesting to see the results, and it will help position us for the future.
Okay. Well, Representative Falk renews her motion that House File 2028, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. And we are adjourned.